everyone, and welcome to the History of England. Just before I start, all the poll, quiz, prizes, and when I'm going to return stuff is right at the end of the interview with Nicola. Okay? So, now, you have been through 7 days of Lady Jane, so as a reward, today I have a treat for you, and I'm very happy to say that I am joined by Nicola Tallis.
Hello.
Hello, Nicola. So Nicola is an author of a book that I used constantly throughout the episodes. And I have to say, I loved your book. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, just to get my compliments in early, obviously. I enjoyed it because you did a really good job of making the atmosphere live, of giving a really good idea of exactly what happened, who was doing what, of making the characters live again. So I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's very nice to hear.
Did you enjoy researching it?
I had a great time researching it. Yeah, it was wonderful. It took me to some unexpected places, and I learned a lot more about Jane than what I was expecting to. So it was a brilliant experience.
So on the way, did you go to Bradgate Park?
I did. I went to Bradgate Park. I've actually spoken at Bradgate Park
on
two occasions now. Yeah, I was fortunate enough actually to be there earlier this year to deliver a eulogy for Lady Jane Grey at the remembrance service that Bradgate Park run for her every year. So I did spend some time there researching, which was a real privilege. And it was great to be somewhere that was such an integral part of Jane's life and where, you know, much of her early life was shaped.
Where do they hold their remembrance service?
That is held in the chapel, the ruined chapel, within the ruins of Bradgate Park.
Gosh, how lovely about that. That's fantastic. Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful park, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely stunning. And, you know, the great thing about Bradgate Park as well is that the landscape is so largely unchanged since Jane's time. So many of the views would have been familiar to her too.
Yes, that's amazing, isn't it? Such a beautiful deer park, such a good example of a deer park from the Tudor period.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. It really does transport you back in time, I think. And it is a very, very beautiful place.
The only thing, of course, there's an upturned beer tankard on a hill, isn't there, which presumably wouldn't have been there when Jane Grey was there. And presumably she would have got rid of if there had been.
Yes, absolutely.
So what was it that drew you to writing about Jane specifically?
Well, actually, initially, I began researching and writing about her mother, Lady Frances Brandon.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote a first draft of a book, and I showed it to my agent, and he'd said, you know, this is really great, but I wonder if it's worth actually going back and having a look at Jane. And initially, I was sort of slightly hesitant because I felt that, you know, we probably knew everything that there was to know about her and there wasn't much more to be said. But actually, I was very pleasantly surprised to discover that, you know, when I actually did go back to the archives and look at the original sources, that there was more to be said about her and more of her character to be drawn out.
Interesting. Before we go on with that, I'm interested that you wrote about Frances first. Because she was rather strange that she was written out of Henry's will. What was going on there, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, she, as you say, she was written out of the will, and the reason has never been satisfactorily established. But for my own part, I personally believe that it was probably had something to do with Frances's husband, Jane's father, Henry Grey, because we know that Henry VIII didn't have a great deal of time for him. He was, I mean, basically, not many of his contemporaries had a good word to say about Henry Grey. And we know that he'd been nominated to join the Order of the Garter on several occasions throughout Henry VIII's reign. And Henry always rejected him and chose somebody else. Yet as soon as Edward VI succeeded, shortly after Henry Grey became a Knight of the Garter. And, you know, I think also Henry Grey, he just didn't distinguish himself in any capacity during Henry VIII's reign. You know, we know that he accompanied the king to France in 1544, and he did nothing. So none of his contemporaries held a particularly high opinion of him, and I think that Henry VIII certainly recognised this. And of course, if Francis had succeeded to the throne, then really that would have brought Henry Grey with her too. And as I say, I really don't think Henry VIII held his abilities in any great regard, and I can't say I blame him.
No, I really like the theory, actually. And of course, during the story of his daughter's accession to the throne, as it were, he doesn't cover himself with glory either, does he, really?
No, not at all. He was very, very weak, a very naive character. He was very intelligent, actually, but I think that was probably the only nice thing that his contemporaries had to say about him. Everything else, he was very easily led, and I think the events of 1553 certainly show that.
It was certainly a desperate part of the story, and yet he and his daughter did seem to share a bond, or it seemed that way to me.
Yeah, I agree, and I do think that they had a close relationship. I think, you know, one of their contemporaries remarked upon the fact that Jane was her father's favourite daughter, and I do think that that's true. I think that certainly their relationship was bonded by their shared academic interests, and so I certainly think that the relationship between them was not as cold as it has sometimes been portrayed.
Certainly Henry leaving his daughter in the Tower was, for me, one of the saddest parts of the whole story.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I do also think in many respects he didn't have an awful lot of choice, but yeah, absolutely. I don't think he did enough to keep her safe, I suppose you could say. And I think that his sort of actions reflect that, but I do think ultimately he loved her, but just perhaps didn't have the strength of character to protect her.
I'm delighted to hear, by the way, that one is allowed to have favourite children. I will tell my children that, and I might nominate one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You could in the 16th century anyway.
Oh, perfect. Down. I should go back to 16th century. So, Nicola, what kind of person did you think Jane was?
I thought she was a very strong person, given her age. She was clearly extremely intelligent, exceptionally intelligent, actually. And I think that that's perhaps one of the sides of her character that's quite often neglected. And, you know, the people forget that she was, you know, this woman of extraordinary intellect who was conversing with men who were, you know, a lot older than her abroad. So she, you know, she strikes up a correspondence in her teenage years with the Protestant theologian Heinrich Bullinger. And I think this gave her a great source of fulfillment on both a personal and an intellectual level. And, you know, she wasn't afraid to stand her ground and to say what she thought on occasion, which, again, is quite remarkable in an age in which women were wholly expected to be subservient to the male figures in their life, whether it be their husbands or their fathers. I think she did manage to find her voice in a male-dominated world.
Yes, absolutely. There was one particular point where she refused to give Guildford a throne or a crown, or to be king consort, as it were.
Yeah.
Which must have taken remarkable strength of character.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that was a real shock as well to the Duke of Northumberland, her father-in-law, as well as to Guildford, actually. And I think, you know, until then they had sort of assumed that she was going to be easily manipulated and very compliant with their wishes. And so for her to actually stand up and say, well, no, actually, I'm not happy to do this, unless commanded to do so by Parliament, then I think, you know, that was a very brave thing for her to do.
Yet, of course, she was a fiercely convinced evangelical as well, wasn't she?
She very much was, yeah. And this seems to have grown throughout her life and become, you know, she seems to have become increasingly fervent in this faith particularly towards the end of her life. But yeah, you certainly see evidence of this earlier in her life as well. If you do read her letters to Heinrich Bullinger, there are three of them that survive. And in this, you know, we basically have her many of her religious views on paper, and you can see just how much religion meant to her, and it really was an integral part of her life and her being.
So, yes, I remember reading a biography of Thomas More, wherein the biographer talked about his historiography, and he made a comment that all his biographers came to like Thomas. So as you were going through this, did you come to like Jane?
I, in many respects, I came to like her, but I have to be honest, I don't feel that she was necessarily always the easiest heroine.
Yeah.
I think she was very much a typical teenager in many ways, and I think she would have been difficult to live with on occasions, certainly when her stubborn streak started to come through. But of course, certainly during the events of 1553 and ultimately her death in 1554, you can't help but feel a great deal of sympathy for her, and you know, also admiration. But I would say, yeah, generally overall as a person, I had very mixed feelings towards her.
And what sort of sources of information do we have about her? How easy was it to get inside her head?
I mean, we are lucky in a sense that there are the sources that we have are you know, very useful. For example, we've got the transcript of her trial from 1553, which is, you know, a great source of information, although doesn't tell us a great deal about Jane. And we also have ambassadors' reports, you know, where they're offering their views about her. And we have official documents such as, you know, there's an inventory of jewels that was delivered to Jane while she was queen in the Tower. But for Jane herself, we only have a handful of her letters. And these were primarily the ones that she wrote in to Heinrich Bullinger from Bradgate Park, largely. But also... we have a couple of letters that she wrote whilst in the Tower. So it is very difficult to try and glean glimpses of Jane. And you just sort of have to try and piece together what you've got and see what it tells you, really. Mm. And, you know, inevitably there are, with any historical subject, but especially with Jane, I think, there are gaps, frustrating gaps in the evidence. And, you know, it's not always safe territory to speculate on what somebody might have been feeling or thinking at that time.
Yes, very hard. I was also, as far as I could see, quite a lot of the information we have about her are from Catholic sources, who presumably every source, I guess, has an angle. But that must be something you'd need to filter a little.
Yeah, of course. You always have to look at where a source is coming from and why they might hold that particular view. But some Catholic sources were actually quite sympathetic towards Jane, which I found quite interesting. But, you know, there are so few sources really for large periods of her life. And, you know, we don't even know exactly what Jane looked like, because there are no authenticated likenesses of her, and we only have very, very small snippets of information from contemporaries. I think there was one Venetian contemporary who made a couple of observations about her appearance, and really that's it. So, yeah, you do have to filter everything, and you do have to consider how genuine and authentic everything is. So, that's just part and parcel of writing any historical biography.
Yeah, I guess the thing about Jane is she kind of transcends her youth, helps her transcend some of the normal battle lines, doesn't it, somehow?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Although, something I do think is important to remember is that although we remember her now as being this young, probably 17-year-old girl at the time of her death. You know, back in the 16th century, concepts and ideals of maturity were very different, and 17 wouldn't have been seen as young as we sort of perceive it to be today. But I think also, of course, Jane was a woman and a little known woman relatively. And so I think that's also helped her to slip under the radar a little bit. And, you know, generally at that time, people were not spending a great deal of time talking about women, let alone a young girl from Leicestershire who very few people had heard of prior to 1553.
Yes, even from Leicestershire, the forgotten county, obviously.
That said with some bitterness
and resentment, Nicola. But Jane must have had people obviously around her, and we've talked about a couple that she would have turned to in the crisis. Who were those people, and what sort of support do you think they gave her?
I think relatively she had little support, really. I mean, we know that she had her mother with her, and her father and her husband, and then the Lords of Edward the Sixth Council, who were gathered at Sion House to inform her of the death of Edward the Sixth and the fact that she was now queen. And for my own part, I do believe that Jane had quite a good relationship with both her parents, including her mother. But really, at this time, there's not an awful lot that they can do for her. She has sort of been thrust into the forefront of affairs unwillingly, and I really don't think that she had anyone that she could really turn to for support at that time, because she was really forced to go along with events, whether she liked it or not.
She's put in an extraordinary situation. How does she react when she's offered the throne?
She completely broke down. And, I mean, she had to deal with the fact not only that her cousin King Edward was dead, but that suddenly she had been thrust, you know, from third in line to the throne by the terms of Henry VIII's will, to suddenly she is the queen. And she was utterly distraught. And, you know, there are reports that say that she cried out that the crown is not my right, it pleaseth me not, the Lady Mary is the true queen. And I think that really she was utterly horrified by what was before her. But ultimately, of course, she did have the pressure of all these men bearing down on her, and she may not have wanted the crown, but I think that ultimately she accepted it and believed that it was God's will that she did take that crown.
So who was it then? Who's responsible for this? Whose idea and plan do you think it was to put Jane on the throne and exclude Mary from the succession? And why did they want to exclude Mary from the succession?
I think it comes down to, I think it's a combination, really, of the Duke of Northumberland, who, of course, eventually becomes Jane's father-in-law, and Edward the Sixth. And the reason that they wanted to exclude Mary was quite simply because she was a Catholic. Edward was a stringent Protestant who had spent the entirety of his reign tirelessly imposing new religious policies on his subjects in an attempt to convert England to a thoroughly Protestant country. And he didn't want Mary to be given the opportunity to undo all of this, which she undoubtedly would if she became Queen of England. And so I think Edward realised when he was when it became clear that he was dying, that Mary needed to be removed. And the only way that that he could ensure a Protestant succession really was by appointing Jane as his successor. He couldn't exclude Mary without also excluding Elizabeth, his younger half-sister, the younger of the half-sisters, and even though she was a Protestant. So both half-sisters are struck out of the succession on the grounds of their previous illegitimacy, which had been enforced by law during the reign of Henry VIII. And, you know, and technically the next in line to the throne then should have been Frances, Jane's mother. But we've already alluded to the fact that Henry VIII had actually cut her out. And also, she didn't really have, she wouldn't have had any support for her claim anyway. The Duke of Northumberland is the main power force in the land at this time. And he very conveniently arranges for Jane to be married to his fourth son, Guildford. And so, therefore, you know, Jane is the obvious candidate. And, you know, Northumberland, what his support was essential if Jane was to succeed to the throne as Queen of England. So I think that, you know, he persuaded Henry Grey and Francis to fall in with his plans. And I don't think that they needed great, well, I certainly don't think Henry needed a great deal of persuasion. And so, yeah, plans went ahead.
The debate about whether it's Edward or whether it's the Duke of Northumberland has wandered around during the ages. So you came to the conclusion that it was Edward as much as anybody who defined the succession.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that Edward was instrumental and a key part in it, because, you know, Northumberland couldn't have done it, couldn't have machinated that alone. Edward's connivance was necessary. And of course, he does draw up the famous My Device for the succession in his own hand. And I do very much believe that it was really, he may not have considered Jane initially, but I do ultimately think that, yeah, it was his decision to name her as his heir.
So who then was the rebel queen in 1553?
Good question. I think it's a very difficult question to answer, actually. Yeah, you can see it from both sides, because Edward's device for the succession was never passed through Parliament. So what he had done, excluding both of his half-sisters from the succession, was illegal. So technically, I suppose on those grounds, you would have to say that it was Jane who was the rebel queen.
Right. OK. So Jane is announced to be queen. What's the reaction of the London and the country to this proclamation?
Utter amazement and horror, I suppose, because, as I mentioned earlier, nobody really knew who Jane was. And at a time when people rarely ventured very far from their hometowns, you know, they had no idea who this girl who'd been living in distant Leicestershire was. She wasn't a frequent presence in London in the same way as Henry VIII's daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, and neither did she have their popularity. So, you know, it's little wonder that these people in London, confronted with this girl, they've got no idea who she is. And, you know, they believed that the throne was Mary's right rather than Jane's, and were not happy about that right being taken away from her at all.
Yeah, so they're dumbfounded, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you think that made a difference to the end result?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I think it's often one of the misconceptions about Jane is that her reign was doomed to failure from the start. But actually, precisely the opposite is true, because initially, all of the odds seemed to be stacked in Jane's favour. And even Mary's supporters were urging her to flee abroad for her own safety initially, because they believed that, you know, Jane was going to be queen. But I think Mary ultimately played her trump card, because she fled into East Anglia, where she was a very popular landholder. And from there, she was able to build up a huge base of a network of support, which grew daily. And, you know, people were hearing continuously that people were going over to Mary's side, which encouraged more people to follow. And also, I think that Jane made, well, there were two mistakes made. And the first of these was to allow the Duke of Northumberland to leave the Tower and to leave London at the head of Jane's forces. And this was a mistake on two fronts, because first and foremost, with Northumberland away from the Tower and from London, there was no strong, powerful figurehead to hold all of Jane's supporters together. Because, as I've already mentioned, Jane's father, Henry Grey, was very weak. Nobody had any respect for him. And the same can also be said of Jane. And, you know, the second mistake then was that as Northumberland began travelling into East Anglia in pursuit of Mary, he was extremely unpopular there. And so all of his supporters began deserting and going over to Mary's side. So it was this continuous sort of struggle, really, where day by day, men were just flocking to Mary's banner. And yeah, ultimately, her popularity won the day.
It's interesting. When I was a lad, the story was always that, you know, this was it was inevitable that Mary would become queen. The 9-day queen is it, the very title, 9-day queen, suggests that Jane, there's no way that this was ever going to happen. It's just a blip.
Mm.
And actually, that story belittles both Jane and Mary, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely it does. It absolutely does. And I think, you know, as I said, I do think that it was very much a struggle. Nobody at the time knew exactly which way it was going to go, but it certainly did look for some time as if it was going to go in Jane's favour. Mm. So, you know, it was a very, very uncertain time. And I think really Mary was quite lucky.
Yeah, and it's a decision of some courage, isn't it, on Mary's part, who, of course, doesn't have the greatest reputation in English history. But that decision she makes would have taken a lot of courage at the time.
Yeah, that's so true as well. You know, she could have slipped away abroad. It would have been, it would have been possible for her to do that, or for her to attempt to do that anyway. And so it was very brave of her, I think, to stand her ground and say, well, no, hang on a minute. This is my right and I'm going to fight for it.
Mm.
And you know, she did do so very bravely. So I think, yeah, she does have to be commended for that, certainly.
Another person whose reputation has wandered around over the years is the Duke of Northumberland, of course, who we mentioned. So what's your view of Northumberland? Good Duke, bad Duke, just a Duke? You know, how do we evaluate him?
I don't view him particularly favourably. I think he was very greedy. I think he was also, certainly his behaviour after his after Jane's deposition and his capture is very cowardly, because he was captured by Mary's forces and returned to London to the Tower, this time as a prisoner. And he was condemned and found guilty of treason and sentenced to die. And he tries desperately to avoid this death sentence, even to the extent that he offers to convert to Catholicism, you know, which is apparently the whole reason why he'd tried to prevent Mary from becoming queen in the first place.
Mm.
So he offers to convert to Catholicism, and Mary duly allows him to do this, but then executes him anyway. And certainly Jane had had nothing good to say about her father-in-law. When she heard about his conversion, she was absolutely appalled. But one thing I will say about him is that he does seem to have had a very good and very happy relationship with his wife. And he does also seem to have been a very loving and considerate father. So perhaps in personal terms, he was a nicer person than in political terms.
There are so many images that stick in my head about Lady Jane's story. One of them is the report of the Duke of Northumberland in the Market Square in Cambridge, laughing with the tears coming down his cheek and throwing the coins into the air. It's an extraordinary image, that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think by that time, he had obviously realised that the game was up and his only hope was to throw himself on the Queen's mercy. And I think it says a great deal about Northumberland as a person, actually, that he was pretty much, aside from a couple of others, he was pretty much the only person that Mary was unwilling to forgive. Because by this time, most of Northumberland's colleagues had gone over to Mary and had fled to her side to declare their unswerving loyalty and beg for her pardon. She duly gave. But Northumberland, you know, there's none of that for him. And although he obviously tries his best to try and gain that forgiveness, it's never forthcoming. So it's a powerful image, and it's a quite pitiful image, but ultimately it doesn't do anything to save him.
Jane then spends several months in the Tower, which again is an extraordinary story, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Mary had made it clear that she intended to be merciful towards Jane and spare her life. And there were even reports circulating that eventually, when things settled down, Jane would be set at her liberty. And so for Jane, I think these times, although, you know, being a prisoner in the Tower is obviously an awful experience, I think for her, there was some hope that this wasn't going to be the end. And she had that to cling to, if you like. And I think her experience of imprisonment perhaps wasn't as terrible as some of the other prisoners in the Tower. So, you know, we know that she was allowed access to pen and paper. And Florio, who was her... Michelangelo Florio, who was her Italian tutor, also tells us that she spent a great deal of her time in prayer and studying the Bible as well. So I think in this time she took a great deal of consolation in the things that she knew best and that she took pleasure in her normal everyday life, which was, of course, her books, her education and her religious faith.
There's a lovely anecdote from the visit of Rowland Lee, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah, and you do get, I think that's quite, even though she's obviously a prisoner at this time, I quite liked that image as well. And it's nice to think of her socialising and being able to enjoy the company of others during those days. So yeah, that was at a time when she was at dinner with her the gentleman jailer, Nathaniel Partridge, in the lieutenant's lodgings, which was where she was housed.
It's a fascinating little clip, isn't it? A little insight into a bit of normality and what must have been an extraordinarily unnormal life.
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't get many of those glimpses of Jane. So in a sense, it is nice to have that. But of course, it is also on this occasion that she learns of her father-in-law's conversion to Catholicism, and that seems to put rather a dampener on the evening.
Okay, and then we come to the final stage in Jane's life. As you say, Mary, to her great credit, had decided to be merciful to Jane.
What changed her mind was the Wyatt Rebellion, which was staged in January 1554. And basically this came about because shortly after Mary's accession, thoughts had turned to her marriage. And in reality, there was only one true candidate, in my view anyway. And that was Mary's cousin, Philip of Spain. But the idea of a Spanish marriage was immensely unpopular in England because, first and foremost, Philip was a Catholic, and secondly, he was a foreigner, and it was greatly feared that he would embroil England in foreign wars, as indeed he did in due course. And unbeknown to Mary, and also unbeknown to Jane, there were those within the realm who had decided to oppose this marriage by taking up arms. And this was all done under the auspices of a gentleman from Kent named Sir Thomas Wyatt. And the aims of the plot have been debated, but it's sort of generally agreed now that one of the main ideas was to prevent the Spanish marriage, of course, but also to remove Mary the First and replace her with her half-sister Elizabeth. So none of the plan's motivations included or involved Jane in any way, but there was one big flaw, and that was that Jane's father, Henry Grey, was one of the key conspirators. And again, his involvement, the reasons for his involvement have been debated, whether in reality he really hoped to topple Mary and restore Jane or not. I mean, that's a possibility, but I think he perhaps realised that there wasn't enough support. We do know that he had spoken out against the Spanish marriage, so I do think that, he certainly was greatly opposed to that. But anyway, the rebellion is a dismal failure, and Wyatt and the rebels are rounded up in London and sent to the Tower. Meanwhile, Henry Grey flees to the Midlands, where he is discovered hiding and is also returned to the Tower. And that really seals Jane's fate. But at this point, it is important to highlight, actually, that even now, Mary really didn't want to put Jane to death. She was still trying to think of ways around it. But ultimately, the pressure from her counsellors was too great. And she eventually did give the orders for Jane's execution, all pretty much because her father had been involved in the Wyatt Rebellion. And so, yeah, the order is given that Jane is to be executed.
And thanks, Dad, is probably what she thought when she heard, maybe. Maybe she didn't.
Yeah.
So she dies with extraordinary fortitude.
Yes, absolutely. She does die with extraordinary fortitude. And again, I think she dies with great dignity. But also, it's at this time of her execution that we get another glimpse of Jane the person, I suppose, because she's very composed. She makes a speech to those who've gathered to watch her die, and she reads a psalm from her prayer book. But when she's blindfolded and, you know, everything goes black, she suddenly realised that the block was out of her reach. And it was then that she cried out desperately, "What shall I do? Where is it?" And, you know, it's a panic just suddenly hit her. And it's then that a sympathetic onlooker guides her hands to the block. She places down her head, you know, her composure. She's regained her composure by this point. And then moments later, it's all over.
The thing that affected me almost as much as that, actually, was the conversation that she has, or the brief interplay she has with Dr. Feckenham.
Yes, so Feckenham is Mary's personal chaplain, and he arrives at the Tower after Jane has received the news, that the order's been given for her execution. And basically, the reason for his coming is that Mary has realised that although she's not able to save Jane's body, she does at least want to attempt to save her soul. And the way that she believes that she can do that is by persuading Jane to convert to the one true faith, which of course is, in Mary's view, Catholicism. And Feckenham was initially very confident of success. He really genuinely believed that he could change Jane's mind and, you know, move her away from everything that she'd believed in her whole life. And again, it was at this time that Jane showed her true strength of character, because rather, I think by this time she knew that she was definitely going to die and that there was no way out of it. And so I think that she'd determined that if she was going to die, she was going to be seen to die as a Protestant martyr for the Protestant faith. And so she refuses all of Feckenham's attempts to convert her and stays true to what she believes in.
Mm. And yet on the scaffold, there's a moment between them, isn't there, where she embraces him, and it gives just a glimpse that, you know, there's not just a fanatic in there, which, of course, doesn't travel well across the centuries. There's a real person too, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Feckenham had said that he was going to be there during her final moments. And yes, she does embrace him. And she told him to go and that God may reward him, and, you know, also thanks him for his company. And, you know, in perhaps something that shows her humour at this moment, the report says that she told him that during those few days she was more bored by him than frightened by the shadow of death.
It's so impressive, isn't it? You're going to get your head chopped off and you've got time to crack a gag. It's not bad,
yeah,
is it?
Exactly. So again, you know, I do think that that does give a little glimpse of Jane the person, but extraordinary that she was able to make a remark like that at this moment in time.
Incredible. So her story, of course, has survived so strongly over the years, in spite of the fact that some of the language she uses, so like in her letter to Dr. Thomas Harding, for example, some of her language she uses is that immoderate language that you get in the 16th century around religious difference somehow. So why has her story been so well preserved?
I think really it started from the moment of her death, when her supporters really sort of started to revere her as being this Protestant martyr. And, you know, lots of noted Protestants abroad started writing about her and, you know, talking about how admirable she was in her academic abilities. But also one Protestant gentleman wrote to Heinrich Bullinger, I think it was about a month after Jane's death, that she was remarkable because of the remarkable firmness with which, though a young girl, she surpassed men in maintaining the cause of Christ. And I think this image of Jane as this Protestant martyr just really began to take hold. And, you know, people began to see her more and more as this girl who'd been persecuted because of her religious faith. And so the image of Jane as this victim and this innocent pawn was born very shortly after she died, and gathers momentum as the centuries go on, particularly in the Victorian period, actually, when we see Paul Delaroche's iconic The Execution of Lady Jane Grey painting.
That is quite a work, isn't it?
It is. It's a really, really powerful image. And it is certainly the image of Jane that's conjured up in most people's minds when you talk about Lady Jane Grey, which is, of course, exacerbated by the fact that there aren't any portraits of her. So, you know, this is the image of her, and it's her at this most pivotal moment in her life when she's about to die.
It's I'm half irritated and half awed by it. And we did use it for this sort of little bit of fun we've had over the last week or so. But I was tempted not to, because it does very much present her as a victim. And I guess she was. But yeah. There's so much more to her than that, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that was part of the reason why I really wanted to write this book, was because so often when I told people I was working on Jane, the reaction would be, you know, that's so sad, it's such a sad story, poor girl. And I really strongly felt, and still do feel, that is really doing Jane and injustice, because there is so much more to her than that. And I think that she ultimately should be remembered as a girl who, yes, she did die in sad and tragic circumstances and at a young age, but she also died having achieved so much in her academic career. And you know, who knows, if she had been given the opportunity to live and her life had been her own, who knows what she could have achieved with that. But I certainly think she displayed great academic promise and deserves to be remembered for that more than anything else.
Absolutely. I'm going to give in to the temptation to ask you what you think England would have been like if she had won.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that, because I a couple of years ago, I wrote an imaginary article about what I think would have happened if Jane had succeeded. Yeah, and it's very interesting to consider this. And of course, it's purely speculative. But I wonder if we would have remembered her as being Bloody Jane in the same way that we remember Bloody Mary. Because I do think that, of course, Mary has this reputation for burning Protestants at the stake. But I am tempted to think that Jane may have gone down the same route with Catholics, because we know from the behaviour that she displayed that she was extremely intolerant of those who showed religious beliefs that were at odds with her own. So I do very much wonder if it would have gone that way. And I guess, you know, we can guess that in her personal life, she may have gone on to have children and founded a line of kings and queens. Who knows? But certainly in the political sense, I do wonder if she may have ended up burning a few Catholics.
Yes, I absolutely take your point. Actually, I forgot to ask you about her relationship with Guildford, of course, because I'm going to lead on to, and ask you. I'm a trivial person, Nicola. I'm going to ask you a question about a film. So let me lead into that by asking you what we know about her relationship with Guildford.
Okay. I mean, unfortunately, we don't know a great deal about the relationship with Guildford. We know that Jane didn't want to marry him, and I can't say I blame her. we're also told actually that her mother Frances was vigorously opposed to it, and on many fronts, as I say, you really can't blame either of them, because this was a girl who had been raised with an acute awareness of her royal blood and of her importance, I suppose. And there were high hopes for Jane. There had at one time been talk of possibly arranging a marriage between her and Edward VI, but of course his early death puts paid to all of that. And so for someone who's been raised with expectations of a grand marriage, perhaps to a king and thereby, you know, becoming his consort, the thought of a marriage to the son of a duke, and not even the eldest son of a duke, but the fourth son, is a real come down. Mm. So I'm not at all surprised that she wasn't happy about this marriage, but she did go through with it. It was a very grand marriage. We've got a detailed accounts of what happened and the arrangements that were put in place. But really, we don't know a great deal about their personal feelings for one another. We know that certainly the accounts state that during the days of Jane's reign, Guildford behaved very petulantly towards Jane, of course, specifically when he was told that she wasn't going to make him king, and he wasn't happy about that at all. But then there are also reports that say that he asked to see her in their final days, but that she refused, saying that, you know, they would soon meet again in a better place. And I think there probably wasn't a true love match or anything like that. Perhaps she'd only tolerated him, but I think probably when it became clear that, you know, they were both going to die, I wonder if he wanted to see her because he perhaps felt some remorse at some of the petulance he'd displayed towards her. It's very difficult to tell, but certainly I don't think it was it was the great love match that is eventually played out in the film.
Which leads me on nicely. So have you seen the film, have you, Lady Jane, Helena Bonham
I've
Carter?
I've seen it many times.
Have you? Yeah. How many times have you seen it?
Oh, gosh. countless times.
Countless times.
A lot, yeah.
So you like it then?
well, it's a leading question, isn't it? I can't say I dislike it because it was what drew me to... It was one of the reasons that drew me to Jane in the first place. I remember watching it when I was younger. I still can't watch the whole film without crying now because of the music.
yes, the music's very good, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I do think that it gives... I do think that it gives a good sense of the times. In terms of historical accuracy, of course, I don't think it's particularly accurate across the board. But I definitely think it does a good job of conveying some of the tragedy of Jane's story, and perhaps also conveying that she wasn't always the easiest of teenagers at times.
Yes, she does. I mean, Helena Bonham Carter does do a pretty good job, doesn't she, of portraying a real person and making it come to life.
Yeah, I think she was definitely well cast. So, I think she did a great job, actually. And I certainly, I see her as Jane. I certainly believed she was Jane.
So, look, I have another podcast called History in Technicolor, which is where we talk about history films. And in a kind of trivial way that you do with these things, we give it two marks every film once we've had our discussion. One is a score from 1 to 10 of historical accuracy. So, Nicola, I'm going to ask you to mark the film in terms of historical accuracy, 1 to 10.
Okay, I'm going to give it, a 5.
5. Fair, I think. Harsh, but fair. I'm going to ask you to score it from 1 to 10 for its quality as a film.
Oh, for its quality as a film. Okay, I'm going to be a bit more generous now and say a 7.
7. Sounds like a good mark. But I'll keep those marks secret from my colleague on the show until afterwards, and I'll reveal it to him afterwards.
Oh, fantastic.
So, and one more question. I understand that the experience of writing a book hasn't obviously been too awful because you've written another book. What's your latest project about?
Yes, I absolutely love writing. I wrote a second book, which in some ways, to me at least, it felt like the next part of the story for some of those that were involved in Lady Jane Grey's life. It doesn't seem immediately obvious, but it's called Elizabeth's Rival, The Tumultuous Tale of Lettice Knowles, Countess of Leicester. So that was released last autumn. And it's basically a great Tudor catfight. That's how I describe it, because one of my reviewers described it in that way, and I thought it was great. But basically about a woman, Lettice, who was a kinswoman of Elizabeth I, and... she gained the Queen's enmity after daring to marry the Queen's favourite, Robert Dudley, who was, of course, one of Guildford's older brothers. And she has to deal with, Lettice has to deal with the consequences of this marriage for the rest of her life. So that was released last autumn, and I'm currently working on my third book.
Oh, what's that going to be then? My God, you are a glutton for punishment.
I am a glutton for punishment. I'm not allowed to disclose
Fair enough.
It is another Tudor book, and it will be released next autumn.
I used to be a commissioning editor for My Sins in my previous life. So
fantastic.
I've always been incredibly impressed with authors for the extraordinary hard work it takes to write a book, not less all the... notes, indexing, bibliographers, nightmare. You think you finished the book, then you've got about another half of it to do.
I know.
It's a nightmare.
Always comes as a shock to the system.
But I thought I'd done it. No. Very, very good. Thank you, Nicola. That was great. Very interesting indeed. I love your book, as I say. And you're going to put a free one up for a prize, I think. Copy of Crown of Blood. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can sign it. And
oh, that'd be lovely, yeah. Would have been slightly awkward if you'd said no there at that point.
Would have been a bit awkward.
It wouldn't have. But fortunately you didn't. Great. Okay. Lovely to talk to you, Nicola. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Very good.
Great. Thank you.
Well, how lovely was that? We recorded it ages ago as it happened, so it's really nice to listen to it again. Thanks, Nicola, again. So, that brings us to the four things I need to do before I can release you into the wild again. So, poll, members quiz, when I will return for the next episode, Christmas greetings and all that sort of thing. So, the poll. Well, Northumberland's name remains uncleared, it appears, although it was quite close. Northumberland was condemned as the main culprit by 44% of you, with Mary and the English people generally neck and neck. But look, I figure if I'd done that 20 years ago, Northumberland would have won at a canter. Or he would have done if Jane Grey had had anything to do with it anyway. So, after a random number draw, we have three winners in reverse order. The order is important because number one spot gets the first choice, second gets second choice, if you see what I mean, of the prizes. So, in third choice is Viri Sessin. Something like that anyway. V-I-R-E-S-S-E-N-I-N. Second place, Tim Prolins. Well done, Tim. Come on down. And number one, the winner, the person who gets the first choice, is Kirilli Harvey. So, well done, you three. I will email you or you get in touch with me, whatever's quicker. Then, the members' poll. Well, before we get to the prize bit, we should have the pride and the glory first. The leaderboard top five in reverse order was as follows. TudorFan36 were fifth, Anthony Wilson fourth, Rao Apana number three, Toma number two, and the winner, the person with the highest score, was Music Chris. Respect all of you. I thought the scores were a bit better this time, I have to say. Not that they were rubbish before in previous quizzes, you know, just saying. Music Chris, I suspect that's not your real name. Music Chris got 96%, and you have to be called Nadia to get anything more than that, so well done. And now to the filthy lucre. The winner of our star prize, the Philip and Mary coin, goes to Ben Larby. I think that's good, because I think you've been a member since December 2016, if my memory serves, Ben. Anyway, well done, Ben. Email me, or I'll email you, whatever. So that's it. Next up, then, bad news, I'm afraid. I have acquired a proper job, a short-term, three-day-a-week job, and it really has messed up my life. I'm only doing it till May, so I will recover my war at that point. But it means I need to take a break from the History of England podcast in the short term, because I just can't cope, just haven't got enough hours in the day. Though, having said that, I am trying to squeeze in the odd interview or two, so something might appear on the feed. But for the main narrative of the History of England, just to be clear, I'm afraid I am not going to return until the 3rd of February 2019. I am very sorry. It's only a month off, really. Well, a bit more than that. I am very sorry, but needs must when the devil drives. And members must take precedence, unfortunately. So I must concentrate on writing shedcasts until I get a bit more time. You might like to know that I'm taking a moratorium on the things that made England too, though not on the History in Technicolor podcast. So look, that is it. That is all the news. Have a thoroughly, amazingly wonderful, lovely and just incredible new Christmas and New Year, because that's what you have to say. You have to say incredible these days, don't you? But I know I shall. And thanks for listening this year. Thanks to my lovely members in particular. Bye then all, and I'll see you next year.